Culture Map presents What's Eric Eating? From the Gal Media Studios in Houston, Texas, here's Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's weekly look at Houston's bar and restaurant scene. I'm your host, Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler. Back for our first podcast of 2018. We had a great first year. I feel like every time I'm out at an event or any other kind of food opportunity, people always come up to me. They're very nice about this little show, and I'm so pleased by that and so proud of it. And I'm so glad that all of you who are listening, that you've subscribed to it on iTunes or Google Play, that you're telling your friends about it. It really does mean a lot, and it feels very good to be back for still in our first year as a chronology, but in the second calendar year of shows. I am joined this week by my good friend, local restaurant consultant, Nathan Ketchum. Nathan, hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. I don't believe people actually come up to you in public and say, I like your podcast. I think you're just making that up.
You saw it happen at Gallon's.
Yeah, I did, but I still am choosing to believe that it doesn't happen.
You believe that I pay that woman to say nice things about us.
I believe that you pay everyone to say nice things about you.
That's not untrue. All right, let us start with the news of the week. I feel like, Nathan, half the time you come on the show, we have a new food hall to discuss. This week is no different.
Yeah, Houston's going to be all steakhouses and food halls pretty soon.
Steakhouses and food halls. Local real estate developer Benjamin Enav has partnered with Clark Cooper Concepts on a new development called Lyric Market. This is coming to downtown, hopefully by the end of the year. 31,000 square feet, 20 to 30 food vendors, 800 parking spaces. This is a food hall on a scale that we have not seen, right? Conservatory has 5 or 6 food vendors and a bar. Finn Hall, the other proposed downtown food hall, still in the planning stages, has about 20,000 square feet. We don't know how many vendors that's going to turn into. I mean, Nathan, you've read the news. You've been to food halls across the country. Is Lyric Market the food hall that's going to take over Houston?
Look, I like the scale of this one, the ability to bring in, you know, several different vendors, show up in one place, just have the ability to pick between a lot of different, you know, choices. I like the one that's opening up in the Heinz Tower where you're
yes getting, the Bravery Chef Hall,
the Bravery Chef Hall, where you can, you know, you're actually going to be cooked in front of at a you know, a chef line. I don't know at this point, man, we peak food hall in downtown Houston, but the fact that they have 800 parking spots and things like that, it's going to help them. Man, I don't know. We're at a weird point here.
You know, I've been interested. I've been following the conversation about this on Facebook a little bit. You know, someone's like, oh, well, they have 800 parking spots. How much is the parking going to cost? It's like, easy, right? We don't even know, like, how many restaurants they're going to have in there or what styles of food they're going to serve. Let's not get in a tizzy about how much the parking is going to cost quite yet. Like, let's space that out a little bit. I think one of the things that Grant Cooper told me that they're committed to is bringing in concepts from out of town, especially for the bakery component, especially for the coffee component and the sushi component. They think those are three key things that the food hall needs to have to be successful. Do you have like a dream team? Is there like if you could have any bakery in the country, is there one that you're really hoping that they sign for this?
Any bakery in the country? That's a pretty tough one. One of my favorite bakeries in the company is done by Thomas Douglas in Seattle. The Dahlia Bakery in downtown Seattle. But he's not going to leave Seattle, so that's nothing more than a pipe dream.
But I am hoping that we see some of the things that have been successful other places. You know, certainly John Tizar just opened Knife Burger at the Food Hall in Plano. I'd like to see a Houston Knife Burger.
That was going to be one of my main comments. If we had a Knife Burger, I would actually show up and eat something. If we had, you know, a sandwich place, kind of like Meat and Bread, the Vancouver, the sandwich place that we've had a few conversations about, or there's a sandwich restaurant called Lardo out of Portland. That's one of my favorite restaurants in the entire country. If there was either those concepts or something very similar, I would show up very readily. As we've discussed, Houston is a very sandwich deprived town. So that could be something to focus on.
You know, and if we're talking pipe dreams, obviously, like, can we get Bouchon? Can we get Thomas Keller to come and open a bakery in Houston?
Yeah, he's not going to do it in a food hall.
Probably not.
but
hope springs eternal.
He could fill his own 30,000 square foot, you know, place and just sell Bouchon stuff. So
right. That's fair. All right, and then.
But yeah, it's stupid. Four, possibly five food halls in downtown Houston. I know the population is going up, but it's not there yet, guys. Come on.
Well, there is more residential downtown than there has ever been.
Yeah,
that's certainly a component of this.
There's more people in this room than there's ever been in the last hour, so.
I don't think that's an accurate, yes, but we will leave this room to go eat. Just as the people who live in all these new apartments downtown will leave their apartments to go find something to eat, and they're going to need to go somewhere. And the dining options downtown are still pretty limited. So this idea that of bringing everything together in one place, obviously it's going to be, lunch is going to be a huge component. It's close to the central business district. Hopefully it'll have tunnel access. That will help.
Yeah, we're getting into the danger zone of, if you're going to open one of these concepts, you better have enough funds, because it's going to be a risky venture opening up any of these concepts in any of these spaces. Hopefully, they're giving enough tenant improvement dollars and enough of an allowance that they're really swaying people to come in and saying, like, hey, we're going to make it worth your while. Come open this concept. We're gonna be more of a partner with you. One of the things I've always liked about food halls around the country is that they've made it more of an interchangeable thing where the chefs could come in easily. They could open a concept quickly, cheaply, and move in and out. And because it was so inexpensive to open a concept, as soon as the chef left, another chef would open a concept, you know, the next day. This doesn't seem to be what is happening. It seems to be like these are going to be mini restaurants, so they're going to be kind of expensive to open. So that's my worry.
Well, we will see. I mean, obviously, it's in the developer's interest to keep the costs reasonable, to lure the kind of tenants that people want to visit. The one thing is that they're calling it Lyric Market, not Lyric Hall. The market component, right, the retail component, is kind of a work in progress. Whether it will have retail options like a fishmonger and a butcher is still kind of up in the air. It will have a larder, charcuterie, olive oils, olives, that sort of kind of high-end, not food accessories, right? It's not cookware, but incidental foods or snacky-type foods. Charcuterie will be a component. Retail wine will be a component, but you're probably not going to be able to buy, you know, produce, except maybe at like a biweekly farmer's market.
Yeah, the farmer's market seems like a smart plan.
All right, so let us move on. We will see what becomes of Lyric Market. Let's move on to the 2018 restaurant that I am the most personally excited about because I will be able to walk to it. Night Heron, the new concept from Agricole Hospitality. They are the prominent local restaurant group that had their eye on the Lowbrow space even before Lowbrow officially closed. Nathan, I know I've told you this story. I want to share it on the podcast. I knew that this rumor was true when I drove past Lowbrow and saw Agricole Hospitality co-owner Morgan Weber standing in front of it with a bunch of guys emptying out the contents of the decor into a dumpster. I don't know if that's quite shoe leather journalism, but I felt, you know, I didn't have to pry into city records or listen to whispers or follow tweets. I just drove past the building and there was the guy who had taken the space.
He could have just been robbing the place.
He was not robbing the place.
Yeah.
He's opening a restaurant. And what's interesting about Night Heron, I mean, there's a lot of things I'm excited about with this, but that they've tapped two of their stars to kind of run the place. Julie Rogers, who has been the assistant general manager at Cultivare for a long time, a very talented beverage mind. She's going to create a great cocktail menu. She's a certified Cicerone, which means the beer list will be good. Jeb Stewart's going to help out on the wine list, and Jacob Pate is going to be the executive chef. Jacob was once a neighbor of mine, so I followed his career with some interest. I mean, I remember when he was working at the Itsy Boys Cafe. He's a little stint at Good Dog, a little stint at Downhouse. He spent a couple of years at Cultivare, and then he spent the last year working for Nobies. And if Night Heron is like, takes kind of the small plates component of the Cultivare menu with maybe the kind of casual vibe of Nobies, and again, I can walk to it. That's going to be a place that I'm at a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if we could get kind of what you were saying and then add in the music component of Nancy's Hustle, it might be the perfect restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, sort of reading this, knowing that it's going to have kind of a very bar-forward component, knowing that it's going to have a pretty nice patio, knowing that it's going to have a dedicated brunch menu, it kind of feels like Agricole is doing their version of Better Luck Tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd really be interested to know what their P-mix, their sales mix they want. You stated earlier privately to me that with BLT, they're trying to do roughly 25% food, 75% alcohol.
Yeah, and that's consistent with what Terry Williams told us when he was on the show.
Yeah, so, you know, it'd be interesting to know what Night Heron wants to do, whether it's 50-50 or, you know, 40-60, or if they're trying to do the same. I would think they're trying to do a little bit more food than BLT just because of the spot.
Yeah, it's right in the middle of a neighborhood, so it really does have to be a neighborhood destination. It's very close to the Manila. So hopefully it can lure some visitors from there. You know, when I asked Morgan Weber about that, we sort of agreed that it's going to be more of a bar than Cultivare and more of a restaurant than 8 Row Flint. So it's going to kind of slot right in between their two most successful concepts.
I mean, if we say 50-50, that makes it a pretty safe concept. I think it's very smart of them to do that with that space. That space has had some trouble over the years, and by making it kind of more of a bar than previous iterations of restaurants in that space, they can you know, kind of give it a little bit higher of a success rate than just making it a standard restaurant, a little bit more friendly to the people in the neighborhood by having more food than just a regular bar, and then obviously the food will probably be good.
Yeah, and then let's move on to our next topic. We keep talking about Houston's limitless appetite for steakhouses. We're going to have Jeff Mastro, one of the owners of Steak 48, on in a little bit to talk about just what a juggernaut of success that has been. But Perry's Steakhouse and Grill, I've described it as a suburban steakhouse chain because every major Houston suburb, Katy, Sugar Land, Memorial's not really a suburb, but it's kind of got a suburban vibe. Woodlands, Clear Lake, what have you, they all have a Perry's. They all do very well. They have claimed the former California Pizza Kitchen space on West Gray in the River Oaks Shopping Center. They're going to open a almost 13,000 square foot, two-story Perry's in the heart of River Oaks. We've seen a lot of new steakhouses. We're going to talk about Mastro's as our restaurant of the week. Recently, we talked about Chris Shepherd's plans to open Georgia and James, where Underbelly currently is. Doris Metropolitan has been a new restaurant that I've been particularly excited about. Nathan, if we're approaching peak food hall, have we reached peak steakhouse?
I feel like we reached peak steakhouse a while ago, but they keep opening and they keep doing well, so I'm not really sure what to say about that. At some point, some of these less successful steakhouses will have to close, but they keep hanging on with their regulars and with, I'd assume, corporate business. Perry Steakhouse is... it's kind of always been a suburb steakhouse, like you mentioned. They've always been pretty busy, and man, they got a great location in this spot.
Yeah, it's a great location. They have a very devoted following. So, in that sense, I think they're in a good spot. Talking about residential development, Weingarten is about to build the Driscoll, a 30-something story luxury high rise. It'll basically be across the street. So, you know, if you're the sort of person who might purchase a property or lease a property at the Driscoll, knowing that you can walk across the street and get a great steak, I think that's got to be pretty appealing.
Yeah, Perry's is definitely what I would call an old school steakhouse. They have not modernized with the rest of some of the other steakhouses in Houston. So it'll be interesting to see if this one in the loop, changes the menu a little bit, or if it does the same kind of old steakhouse standards that every other one has.
Yeah, you'll know that Perry's is getting that kind of modern feel if they have a Wagyu program.
Yeah. I do have to say, growing up, I did like the seven-finger pork chop.
Say Perry's classic.
Yeah, and the, can never go wrong with fried asparagus topped with, jumbo lump crab and... butter sauce.
No. I know that kind of old school, kind of fussy cuisine gets made fun of in hipper food circles, but it's not like it ever stopped being delicious.
Yeah.
All right. And then I do want to hit, I do have two other topics I want us to cover briefly. Dat Dog, the New Orleans-based hot dog chain, has announced where its first Houston location will be. They're coming to Rice Village. The plan is to be open by the start of the 2018-2019 academic year. I have not been to Dat Dog. I have not been to New Orleans very recently, unfortunately. But I am intrigued by this. They have different kinds of hot dogs. They have an andouille dog. They have a boar sausage, a gator, a vegan option. They offer 30 toppings. We've seen a lot of changes in the dining options around Rice Village. Hopdoddy opened last year. Shake Shack is coming. You and I have developed an unhealthy obsession with Susie Cakes that I don't really want to talk about publicly because it's embarrassing. Not that the cakes aren't good. It's just I shouldn't be eating that much of it. Are you excited about Dat Dog?
I am. I'm a lot more excited than I thought I would be for a hot dog place from New Orleans. But hot dogs are about $8. They're fairly large. Several different types, like you said, 30 toppings. They have several different types of sausage. They have duck sausage, andouille, gator. They have a spicy, I think, jalapeno pork sausage, which is one of my favorite types of hot dogs. So I'm looking forward to that. So I definitely will be there early to try all the different types of sausage to see if there's anything that I like, all the different types of toppings. And my wife really likes hot dogs. She's a big fan of good dogs. So if this gives us a new version to try, then we'll definitely be there. And if we like it, we'll be there often.
Yeah, and it's close to Rice University, obviously, very close to the Texas Medical Center. Open late. I can just see, bleary-eyed residents dredging in at the end of a shift, like sitting down for a hot dog and a beer before they go home for the night. It feels like it's going to be, feels like it's the right fit for an area that's still got a lot of bars, not a lot of late night dining options. This feels very promising to me.
Yeah, the concept feels like a very good fit for Houston in general.
Yeah, and they're going to open as many as 25 across the Houston area. I don't know that I find that a little hard to to fathom, but we're not really a big hot dog eating town other than James Coney Island. But
yeah, well, that's how franchises work. There's always a max number that they throw out, and then they'll open a considerable, you know, considerably less than that.
All right, more or fewer than 10?
I'd say they'll probably open 8.
All right, very good.
That's my pin.
That's your pin. All right, noted. We will keep track of Dat Dog's growth over the years and hold you accountable for this 5 or 6 years from now.
Yes.
And then our final news item of the week, and I don't want to dwell on it too long, but Ben Berg, the owner of B&B Butchers, has purchased Carmella's, the Memorial Area Italian Restaurant Institution. It was open for 37 years. The owner, Carmelo Moro, announced that it was going to close so that he could retire. Ben Berg stepped in, purchased the restaurant from Carmelo. It will live on. His brother Daniel has moved to Houston from New York to take over as executive chef in advance of Ben's upscale Benjamin's concept that's coming to downtown at some point in 2018. Ben's been very tight-lipped about his plans for that particular restaurant, but I'm always happy to see established restaurants stick around. So I think this is good news for people in the Memorial area, but I've never been to Carmelo's. Nathan, have you ever been to Carmelo's?
I have never been to Carmelo's. It was not even on my radar, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and it wasn't really on mine either growing up. Our red sauce Italian restaurant of choice was always the Lasagna House that still is at Eldridge Parkway and Westheimer. But knowing that Ben Berg is involved and knowing that it's got a new lease on life, I'm headed to Carmelo's soon. I want to know more about this.
Yeah, I'd like to give it a try with the current menu, and then I definitely want to give it a try after his brother Daniel gets in. Someone who has spent time in New York, and you know, hopefully we'll bring some New York Italian, you know, flair to it.
Yeah. All right, that does it for the news of the week. We will be right back with our restaurant of the week. Stick around.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
So for our restaurant of the week, I would like to talk about our trip to Mastro Steakhouse. This is Tillman Fertitta's new palace to all things beef and glitz. Just opened up at the Post Oak, his luxury hotel that's going to open up later this year. We're going to have Jeff Mastro on the show next. He was he and his brother founded Mastro's. They sold it to a private equity firm who sold it to Landry's. So he's no longer involved. They're not related anymore. But we had a wildly over-the-top, wildly expensive dinner. Nathan, I'm just going to throw it to you. What were your impressions? What were your expectations for Mastro's before we even walked in the door?
So before I walked in the door, I expected it to be over-the-top. I expected it to be expensive. Expected service to be fantastic. And all those things were true. I expected the steaks to be perfect. That was the hiccup, I think.
Right. So let's come back to the actual food in just a minute. But the environment is dramatic. I mean, it's dark, it's loud, it has sort of three very distinct areas. There's the bar. It was very lively, very crowded, had a massive liquor display. Everybody was standing around there. They had the patio out to the side with the waterfall that I actually thought was really nice, like something very different. And then just a big, large room that was the main focus of the restaurant.
Several restaurants over the years have attempted to bring Vegas to Houston. All of them have been cheesy, over the top, kind of over the top in a bad way, and genuinely terrible. This is the first restaurant that I think actually kind of achieves that goal of bringing a piece of Vegas to Houston in a good way, bringing the fun, the kind of feel, the excitement. You walk in the door and you're like, oh wow, it is loud in here. It's fun. It's kind of, you know, you got to force your way to the hostess stand through a throng of people. If you want to get to the patio, you have to, you know, tango with about 46 people just to get there. It is busy. Everyone is considerably more attractive than you. the patio was busy. Like you said, the waterfalls were gorgeous. There was a band playing very good music, having a really good time. People kind of doing that half dancing while they're eating.
Yeah, I looked over at one point and said, is that George Springer? And we quickly concluded that it was not George Springer, but it certainly feels like the kind of place where it would not be out of place to see any sort of professional athlete, any celebrity that's visiting town. This feels like where they're going to be.
Yeah, he's probably been there five times already, so.
He just wasn't there that night.
Yeah, well, he probably was there that night, just a different part of the restaurant.
Yeah, it's really big. It would be hard to, you could easily know people in the restaurant and not see them just because of the scale.
Yeah.
Now, I think the food, let's say the menu is enormous. I broke it down for an article on Culture Map. Dozens of appetizers, about a dozen sushi options, 20 different steaks, dozens of sides. It's hard to get your hands around. It's hard to know what to order. Confronted with all that, we made some decisions. We decided not to do the Seafood Tower, which they present in a very dramatic fashion with dry ice. It was hard to get a fix from my perspective on how much that was going to cost. They're a little bit vague about that. And so I was nervous. I knew it was going to be an expensive meal. We'll get to that in a minute. But we settled on a couple of traditional appetizers, some of the sushi, which is something they really pride themselves on. And that's really when things started to go off the rails for us.
Yeah, the menu is not necessarily Cheesecake Factory big, but for a steakhouse, it is maybe twice the size it should, in my opinion, it should be. There are, 20-something appetizers?
I think that's right.
And then, you know, there's sushi, which is a thing that's happening on that menu.
Yeah, we tried a couple of the different sushi rolls. They were very expensive. They were almost $30 each. And
yeah, a member of the party that dined with us really wanted to try them, which I guess is why they have them on the menu, but
They weren't good. We had a lobster roll that didn't taste like lobster. We had a hamachi and jicama where you got the crunch of the jicama, but none of that just fatty richness that makes hamachi so delicious. We had surprisingly good dim sum style fried dumplings. That was a positive.
Yeah. So the sushi, my take on the sushi, it was expensive sushi, but the quality you get is if you went to like raw sushi. In the
yeah,
area.
Yeah. I mean, I never want to compare any restaurant sushi to raw, but I'd say maybe a little bit better than that. But certainly, you know, way more expensive than Kata Robata, and not nearly close to
nowhere
the quality.
Not even the same stratosphere. So,
and then we tried a couple of more traditional appetizers. We had a smoked salmon.
The salmon was pretty good.
We had crab cakes that were pretty good, but when your corporate sibling is Vic and Anthony's, which has the best crab cakes on earth, you know, I think that was a mistake on our part. We shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, it's hard to, if we didn't have Vic and Anthony's to compare them to, we probably would have said they were pretty good.
Yes. And then we ordered steaks since we were four people and we were kind of in a festive mood. We ordered a Australian Wagyu tomahawk ribeye to split and a bone-in filet to split and some lamb chops. And the biggest problem with the steaks was that they were both cold in the middle, which is just not acceptable, really.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to do when your steaks are served on a 500-degree sizzling plate. But they were cold. They were stone cold in the middle.
They were sliced before they served them to us. Do you think that had an issue? Was that part of the problem?
It could have been. I still am baffled at the fact that they're cold on such a hot plate. You know, the fact that they were thinly sliced, I feel like the heat would have transferred even quicker from the plate, but maybe the heat didn't transfer. But cutting the steak, resting it, and then cutting it definitely would have stopped, you know, any heat transfer through the steak. But yeah, they were undercooked and stone cold, both steaks.
And then we had sort of good and bad with the side dishes. We had a lobster mashed potato, which is, it's $38. It's an absurd amount of money to pay for mashed potatoes, but they did have a lot of lobster in them, a lot of lobster flavor. And that is the kind of side dish that you want at a place like Masters. You want that over the top, no holds barred side dish. So that I would get again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I had no complaints over the $38 lobster mash. It is what it's supposed to be. It's over the top. It's crazy. Very lobster forward. Good amount of lobster in the mashed potatoes. It was good.
It was the $34 crab and truffle gnocchi that was the big disappointment. No crab flavor.
Yeah, I had to search through the gnocchi to find any crab.
But then
we could have just gotten a rough order on that one. But there was very little crab. There was some truffle. You could find the truffle. But frankly, the flavor wasn't the best on that one. It wasn't my favorite.
Right. And then the other thing that we...
I do have to say before we move on, the lamb was very good.
The lamb was excellent. It had a great crust. It had a beautiful flavor.
Yeah,
it was
perfectly
cooked right. Yeah. I would get that again in a heartbeat.
For sure.
Now, we had three desserts, which was silly. We probably shouldn't have done that because really the only dessert you should get when you go to Masters is the butter cake. It was incredible.
You should get three versions of the butter cake.
Yeah, if you're four people, you will definitely want two to split, unless you're just so full you're going to burst.
Or four of them.
Yeah, it was delicious.
It is that good.
So the problem is that if we had just eaten those things, we probably would have been okay price-wise. We were with two friends of ours who are definite wine enthusiasts. We let them order the wine, which was an expensive decision since both bottles they ordered were over $200. And in cocktails and a $80 order of Wagyu Hot Rock that we got for some reason that I still don't complete, that was whispered to a server and that I was told not to worry about. All in, we tapped it at about $1,300 before tax and tip for four people. I should say that did also include two glasses of Dom Perignon that one of our friends sent to his former boss who happened to be sitting next to us. So obviously our total for the night was absurd. I mean, we ordered like assholes and we paid the price for it.
Yeah, so here's the thing on Mastro's. It is definitely the place to go if you want to have an over-the-top, crazy, fun experience, hang out with a lot of other people having over-the-top, crazy, fun experiences. The food was not at its best. Obviously, it's early in their opening experiences. They could get those steaks. You know, it's easy for them to figure out the steaks.
Yeah, the food will get better.
Yeah. We did... the steaks that we did get, the filet, I believe, was just a regular bone-in filet. The tomahawk we got was a Wagyu tomahawk.
Yeah, Australian Wagyu tomahawk.
Australian Wagyu tomahawk. So it was pretty expensive. The flavor was pretty good. I don't know if I would pay the difference for their Australian Wagyu. I'm normally a fairly big fan of Australian Wagyu, but I'm not sure that one came through.
Yeah, I mean, I would stick to a regular USDA prime steak next time.
Yeah.
I would stay away from the sushi. I would focus on the seafood appetizers. That seems to be like their tuna poke, I bet would be very good. Or if I were going to indulge from a financial perspective, maybe you should get the seafood tower. I think that's the one thing I want to go back and try just because the presentation looks so good. It's such a signature element for them. But I think it's going to be a while.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to go have a good special occasion time, go get a seafood tower. It's going to arrive, you know, with the dry smoke kind of coming up. It'll be this crazy presentation. Get some of the either some of the Wagyu steaks if you really want to go all out, or get some of the regular USDA prime. Make sure to ask for a hard sear because we didn't get the hardest of sears. But again, they're pretty new, and man, are they busy.
We went in the middle of the week, and it was packed the moment we got there. It stayed that way through about 9:30, and then they got a second pop when the Rockets game that was being played that night in Toyota Center got out, and seemed like everybody, including Tillman Fertitta, who was at the Rockets game, showed up for a late dinner at Mastro's.
Yeah. Skip the gnocchi. Get the lobster mash. It's worth the...
It's worth the $40.
Worth the $40.
Get the $22 Manhattan.
Yeah, the Manhattan was good, but it was $22. Though their drinks tend to be a one and a half drink, where they have the extra half pour tableside for you, and then get the butter cake.
And get the butter cake.
Yeah, if you're looking for a special occasion place where you really just want to, we really want great service and to really be blown all out, it's definitely worth the try if you have the extra cash, and you want to. You know, you really want to get blown away and get that kind of scene and bassine Vegas-style experience. Masters is the place to go.
All right. That does it for our restaurants of the week. We will be right back with Jeff Mastro from Steak 48.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
I am joined this week by Jeff Mastro, one of the owners of Steak 48. A restaurant that, even in a steak-loving town, by Houstonians' beef-loving standards, has been just an absolute juggernaut since it opened in the summer of 2016. Jeff, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know you're in from Arizona. How often do you come to Houston?
Pretty often. I'm here probably every other week.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep.
Prior to owning Steak 48, you owned a namesake restaurant, Mastro's Steakhouse, which you sold to a private equity firm. You sat out a non-compete, and then you opened another steakhouse. What made you want to get back into the restaurant business?
Restaurants have just, we've been doing it so long. It's just in our blood, and it's just it's a fun business. So we had Mastro's Steakhouse. We had a lot of fun with that. We sold that. We weren't for sale, but circumstances happened. Someone came to us, and we ended up selling. And then we were just dying to get back into it. And we saw an opportunity with a little bit more of a contemporary steakhouse. There was a lot of those traditional steakhouses, including Mastro's. We thought the time was right to start looking at a little bit more of a today steakhouse.
Yeah. How would you say that Steak 48 is more contemporary and less traditional? I mean, we could certainly from its look, you know, you don't have the kind of dark wood and leather booths. You I should ask the question and then let you answer it.
Yeah, but that's exactly. It's the facility to our menus, the look is very different. It doesn't look like you mentioned with all the hardwoods. It's just a lot of the elements we've used are a little bit more. We call it warm contemporary. That's how we like it to feel. It has a nice residential feel to it. And then the menu, we still have. You know, we're still a Great American Steakhouse, but we've added a lot of different appetizers and side dishes to the menu to bring things to today and make the menu an exciting steakhouse menu.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I noticed just looking over the menu and having eaten there a couple of times, you certainly pay homage to the potato in many different forms. It's not just about mashed or french fries anymore. I mean, is that, it's funny. But those are the kind of thoughtful details I think that really kind of set Steak 48 apart. And it's been very popular in Houston. Were you surprised by how enthusiastically Houstonians have welcomed the restaurant?
Absolutely, we're always surprised. I mean, we spend a lot of time. This is our life's work. But every time we open a restaurant, it's just it's just an exciting time. And Houston has welcomed us with open arms. I just think it was great timing for this type of steakhouse for this market and the location. It's just been tremendous how great it's been in our first. 18 months being in the Houston market. It's a great market for us.
What do you hear from people? What is it you hear from your customers that they like about Steak 48? What is it that keeps them coming back?
Yeah, we hear a lot of things. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, there's nothing like this in Houston. I think it's the comparison, because a lot of the steakhouses that are here that came before us were like we talked about, your traditional steakhouse. People love steak. They love steakhouses in Houston. But I think they were looking for something that wasn't your typical steakhouse. They still wanted a great steakhouse menu, but they wanted it in a slightly different setting that was a little more today, a little more high energy, a little more fun. And I think that's what we brought to this market.
Yeah, I mean, that whole downstairs area, that massive bar just really gives a lot of energy to the restaurant. You know, I like to look at the comptroller's numbers on liquor sales. I mean, financially, I mean, it must have exceeded all of your expectations.
It did, absolutely. We continue to just have a great time in this market, and we'll just continue to provide a great product to all our guests.
Have you changed anything about it since you opened? Have you learned anything about Houston that you didn't expect that surprised you?
Not really. We opened with a bang, and it just kept going from there. And so we just kept doing what we did from day one, and it's been working for us.
I know you have a location in Arizona. You have a location in Chicago. Is it hard to divide your time and operate in the various cities?
It's all about, and like in any business, it's all about the people that you have to help you operate your business. And I have some tremendous people, and that's how you do it. Because especially when you operate in three different states, you just need the right people, and you got to put the right people in the right places at the right times. And that's what we do, and that's how we're able to operate in multiple states at this level.
I mean, do you anticipate growing further? Do you have other locations in mind?
Yeah, we're looking to expand. We'll probably grow a couple Steak 48s per year over the next few years. So we're looking in other great markets. We're looking in Dallas. We're looking in Miami, Washington, D.C., Boston. We've been looking at a lot of great markets.
Do you get to visit other Houston restaurants when you're here? Is there any place you've been recently that impressed you or that you're sort of excited about?
I do not visit too many when I'm here because I'm usually in our store. But but I've been to all the other great steakhouses in the Houston area, and there are some great steakhouses here.
You know, Nathan and I talked earlier on the show about our trip to Mastra's, which is now part of the Landry's Empire, the restaurant that you founded. Have you been to the Houston Mastra's yet?
Yes, we've popped by.
What did you think? How is the concept? Has it changed since you sold it? What were your impressions of it?
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit, but I think the one here, they built a tremendous facility, so I think they're gonna do terrific here.
Is there any sort of, is there any like a friendly rivalry? Like, you want to be a little better than they are? Is there an element of that?
No, not really. I mean, it still has our name, so we're rooting for them to succeed.
You're not going to change your last name to Steak 48.
That's unlikely.
But I mean, there. You know, I think what's interesting about both of the restaurants is that there's more of an experiential aspect to it, right? The presentations are a little more dramatic. You know, when Nathan and I had dinner at Steak 48, you know, they make a point of, you know, presenting the side, you know, the side. You don't just serve your own sides, right? The server scoops the sides for you. The seafood towers are very Instagrammable. I mean, there's that whole component, I know. That's a big part of the Mastra's experience, too.
there's definitely some similarities between the two restaurants. Food-wise, I'd give the edge a little bit to Steak 48, just between my last two visits. But they're fairly similar restaurants, with Steak 48 being the more modern kind of. I'd say they're both fun-loving, but Steak 48 was kind of the go tell your secrets loudly, be crazy place. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you want to go hear any secrets from any lawyers in town, go to Steak 48.
Yeah, deeply inappropriate conversation happening at the next table. You were eavesdropping on it.
I was. It was a lot of fun.
But I do think that Steak 48 has that component of, well, I mean, all steakhouses are kind of special occasion or big meals. But Jeff, what do you do to kind of create that atmosphere?
Well, it stems from, it's the combination of everything. It's the entire facility that you build and the look and the feel. The big thing is in our restaurants, it's when people come in and they have a great time and they go home and people talk about feel a lot. And a lot of times people can't put their finger on why, man, that place was great. And it just felt good. A lot of times you go into restaurants and lay people that aren't in the restaurant business, they just know it felt like that was the place to be. It felt like that was really a nice, it felt comfortable. They were comfortable. And that's what we strive for when we build these places, where people can when they're there, they're just saying, man, this is a very comfortable place. And that's what we strive for.
Yeah, there were groups of people taking their Instagram photos by the Steak 48 sign outside. Lots of people at the bar buying rounds of drinks for the other attractive individuals. It's definitely a scene place, a place to have fun, place to meet people, and a place to get good food.
Yeah, well, and what we've done, what you've said, a lot of people, they do that kind of thing, but it's, you can... What's great about Steak 48 is you can come in and, it could be a 18-year-old, two 18-year-olds, on their first date, or it could be six businessmen having a dinner, or it could be, a bunch of women celebrating something in the bar. And the way we built the place is gives people options. There's so many different places. It's a very large two-story facility, but you have very many options. You could be in a real high-energy area around the bar, or you could be upstairs in a quieter room. And, so it accommodates all types of people, which is what we love.
You even have tables by the kitchen, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's people love those kitchen suites that we have. You have these semi-private booths where you can look right down the kitchen line, and you can see everything that happens in the kitchen. And people just like that. It's like going to a Broadway show.
How did you come up with the idea for that? Because I've never seen that anywhere else before.
Yeah, we've seen it was just a version of. I mean, we knew people loved sitting in booths, and we knew people loved looking into kitchens, and it just came to us where, hey, why don't we? If there's a way to have booths right up against the kitchen, and it was really what came to us was the we wanted to do a fully open kitchen, and then we thought the kitchens are really noisy. And plus sometimes there's maybe some language you hear in kitchens that you don't want to hear either. So then we put up the glass, and that helped a lot. So you got this, which really adds. So this floor-to-ceiling glass that we have with our kitchens is really it gives off this dramatic effect of our kitchen, and it just shows – because the food's everything we do. That's it. That's our goal is just serving great food every night. So we have it all, and it's on stage behind this floor ceiling glass, and it's just a very dramatic effect.
Yeah, are there, with steakhouses, right? Like prime beef, seared medium rare. That's the heart of every steakhouse experience. But you sort of, that's sort of the minimum requirement. How did you develop some of the more creative sides? Because I know we had the Hasselbeck potatoes, we had the corn creme brulee. I mean, what was the consideration kind of rounding out the menu with those?
Yeah, that was very important with me and my brother when we were developing the menu for this, our second go around here. We wanted to be a great American steakhouse, but we wanted to take some of the traditional steakhouse items and just tweak them slightly. That's why we have, instead of cream corn, we have our corn creme brulee, which has the turbinado sugar torched on the top of it, so it gives us a little sweetness to it. So it's just a version of a cream corn, but it's just enough of a change, and it brings it to today. And then we had a lot of, I mean, we have our crispy shrimp appetizer, which people just love, and it's but we just added a few things to the menu, so it's not your, you can't be, we always felt in this day and age you can't just be, you know, cream spinach and a baked potato and a T-bone. So you got to be more these days. People are, you know, everybody talks about, you know, foodies, and everybody's a foodie, but people want more. They want more of a food experience, and that's what we've strived for.
You know, one of the other things I think that people are interested in is kind of where their food comes from, especially where their beef comes from. Are you hearing that from customers? Do they want to know, like, where the ranch is and how the animals are raised and those sorts of things? Do you anticipate maybe branding, like, you know, we have 44 farms in Texas, you know, and restaurants sort of tout that beef is for its local and its quality. Is that kind of branding of the beef something that you found is important, or?
It's not as important. What's important and what we hear is people want just the greatest steak they've ever had. And they don't really get into it. They don't really get into where it's from. They don't really care. What they care about is, oh my God, this is the best steak I've ever had. And where it comes from is just a secondary thing. I mean, we source our beef from very specific sources, and we don't stray from it. We only pick the best of the best. No, people aren't. They don't come in and they only want this or that. They come in and they know that they can get a great steak, and that's the only thing that's important to them.
And then you have the seafood component, obviously. Like, how many people order seafood instead of a steak?
Yeah, quite a few. I mean, you'll get, you know, if you get, you know, four people come in, and you'll certainly get one or two that might, you know, we have our chili and sea bass, our salmon, we have our tuna. We sell a lot of seafood. We sell a lot of shellfish as appetizers. We sell a lot of oysters. When you walk in, like we were talking about behind the floor-to-ceiling glass in the kitchen, we have our visible raw bar back there with all the oysters and the crab and the lobster. So we sell a lot of seafood.
You know, and it's so interesting. I mean, you're so focused on the quality of the food. I think you very famously incurred the wrath of Allison Cook. The Chronicle food critic gave you a zero-star review. Were you surprised, or what was your reaction to that?
That was surprising. You know, we at that time we were open for a few months, and that was surprising. But it's you know, we've never skipped a beat since then.
Did it? I've often joked with Nathan about it. It must have really hurt your business. But did you see any reaction from your customers? I mean, was anyone like, I don't know. I'm not trying to trick you into saying anything bad about the Chronicle's food critic, but did
yes,
it did
is.
It? Yes, I am. Did it hurt your did it hurt your business at all?
No. I mean sales just have been increasing month to month. Every month we've been open, and so nothing really happened. I mean, reviews are reviews, you know, and everybody has their opinion, but you know, we just do what we do best, and we do it every day.
So back to steaks. How many different cuts of steaks do you have on the menu? Do you know?
We have our filet, New York, ribeye, and then we have a New York strip, and we have a couple bone-in cuts. So we have
the Kansas City cut,
which is the New York with the bone-in, which is, by the way, my favorite cut.
Yeah, our server wholeheartedly recommended the Kansas City as the house special.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites because it's just I used to be a filet guy, but it's just the New York. It's just especially the New York that we're able to source is just tremendous with the extra flavor you get from the New York.
Yeah, and then you also had several domestic Wagyus from California.
Yes, yeah, we do, and there are people love those. We got a couple. Wagyu fillets, and then we also have this huge tomahawk 40-ounce Wagyu, which unbelievably sometimes you'll get individuals will order it for themselves and be able to do a pretty good job on it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but the Wagyu thing's interesting because that's really taken on. That's a new thing with steakhouses over the last few years. Wagyu is getting people now understand what it is and are expecting to find it in a great steakhouse.
Yeah, and then interestingly to me, you guys had a spinalis on the menu. I don't know, or at least you served it last night. I don't know if it's a regular thing or a special, but I did not get it last night, but it's something I would come back for.
Yeah,
the ribeye cap.
Oh yeah, we call it the butcher's cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tremendous cut. It's actually it's my wife's favorite cut. But
the top portion,
the most tender portion of the ribeye. Yeah, we've been actually shocked about how many we sell. So that's one of our it's not on the menu and it's one of our best sellers.
Really,
it's not cheap either.
Yeah, it was not cheap, but I'll definitely go and get it. I just would have to take my wife because it's also her favorite cut. So.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to share with Eric.
No, I would never expect you to share that. Also, because your wife would be super mad at you if you ate one without her.
That would pretty much be it.
I mean, do you aspire, Jeff, to own other kinds of restaurants, or do you feel sort of comfortable with where you are with steakhouses?
No, we love where we are right now, but we are developing our seafood version of Steak 48 in Scottsdale, Arizona right now, which will open the end of this year. It's going to be called our sister restaurant in Arizona is called Steak 44, and so the seafood version is going to be called Ocean 44 out there. So we're doing a flipped version of the steak house concept with seafood will be at the forefront.
Yeah, we've had it's been a tough road for seafood restaurants in Houston recently. We've seen a few of the high-profile ones close. What do you think are the elements in a seafood restaurant that kind of make them successful?
Well, one thing for us is what we've done and what we did in the past. The key is seafood is not – I don't think seafood or regular – fin fish are as popular as a segment as steak. So what we like to do is go into a market with our steak concept, and then after that's been developed a reputation, then we open up our seafood concept. But the key is you're going to still have a seafood concept, but it's going to have your great steaks on the menu, because we found that you get four people that go out to dinner, you're not going to get – not all four people want to get fish. So that's what we've found. You'll get four people go out to dinner to our seafood place, and they'll get – you might get two people get fish and two people get steak. So I think you'll see that. I think that's important. We've seen some concepts where they go and they're seafood only, and it just it's a lot harder. It's just we're all about giving people options, so I don't think being strictly seafood is a good idea.
In reference to the fairly good seafood restaurants closing in Houston, every time a good seafood restaurant closes, I always think back to old Tillman Fertitta, someone saying back in my childhood that people only want to eat seafood at a seafood restaurant if it's on water. It doesn't matter if it's on a ditch or whether it's on the ocean, but it has to be on water.
Yeah, I know. We talk a lot about that, too. I mean, people do love eating seafood on water, but, you know, we've had some seafood restaurants not on water, and they've done okay.
Yeah. That always comes in my brain every time a seafood restaurant closes. It's like they should put a puddle outside and then put a fountain. It'll be all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Jeff, I think we've I really appreciate you doing this. I think we've sort of explored all the questions about Steak 48 that I had. Nathan, do you have anything else?
Have you been able to hit any restaurant outside of steakhouses, or has there been one steakhouse in Houston that has impressed you?
When we were building a Steak 48, we went to Papa's all the time, Papa's Brothers Steakhouse, and we thought and think that's a tremendous concept.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
They do a great job. Yeah. Yep.
Massive wine list.
Yes, absolutely. It's tremendous, yeah, and the service is tremendous.
But if I wanted a very classic steakhouse experience, I still think Pappas Brothers is where I would go. If you want something a little more contemporary or maybe a little lighter, I think, there's definitely a difference. You can definitely feel a difference between dinner at Pappas Brothers and dinner at Steak 48.
Yeah, they're similar in the fact that both steakhouses, but they're different in terms of style and feel for sure.
Absolutely. We're very different, so.
Well, Jeff, that means that we have reached the point in the show that I like to call the lightning round. Five easy questions, five short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind.
Do my best.
All right, I appreciate it. All right, here we go. What is your favorite steakhouse side?
The Hasselback potato.
Good answer.
What is the first concert you ever went to, first musical performance?
It was with a girlfriend of mine, and it was Motley Crue.
No, that's a very good answer.
Yeah, that's a better answer.
What is your fast food guilty pleasure that has to come from a drive-thru?
Oh, boy. I'm a runner, and after I do some of my long runs, I'll drive through Jack in the Box and get the Supreme croissant.
All right, I ask this to everyone. I know you're not from Houston, so just bear with me, but who is your favorite Houston sports figure, past or present?
I'd say one of our biggest fans here has been Vince Wilfork, and he's a really neat guy.
That's awesome. And then I know you said you're busy, but is there one Houston restaurant that's on your list that you feel like you have to try the next time you're in town?
There was actually, I don't remember the name of it now. The one we talked about last night.
We talked about Nancy's Hustle.
Oh, yeah, Nancy's Hustle, yes. Me and Oliver, who's sitting over here, we are definitely trying that when we're back in town next couple weeks.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for doing this. Of course, we can follow all the goings on at Steak 48 at steak48.com. We will we look forward to an oceans concept coming to Houston in the years to come. Nathan, we can follow you on Twitter at H-Town Food Junkie, at least for now. Maybe more Instagram to come from you in 2018. That's your New Year's resolution. I'm giving that to you. That's what I want you to do.
All right, sure.
And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at eSandler, on Instagram at EricSandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest bar and restaurant news. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week.